How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Meta Sidekicks. My name is Liv and this is the podcast where we talk about all things metaphysical, spiritual, paranormal, and in between. Today is going to be part two of a last week's podcast, which is basically just a metaphysical shower thoughts of pondering the existence of God and gods. So if that's something you're interested in, you found the right podcast. So last week we pondered ideas such as who created the gods and why. And we talked about my idea of the Big Bang, because I feel like the question of who created the gods and why can really just fall under how some people think that God created people, while other people think that people created God. And honestly, I'm of the opinion that both of those statements hold truth, which I feel like is just two clashing thoughts anyways, but I feel like there's always three sides to a story, right? One person's perspective, the other person's perspective, and then the actual truth. And I feel like the truth can be found in the ideas of that, you know, people created God, but God also created people. And I don't want to say God as in like a single entity, being, existence, whatever, because personally for me, I don't think that there is, I think there is a God. However, I do think that there are gods as well. So, you know, this podcast is open to the ideas of anybody that holds this, whether you're on the more like scientific side, which is more so what we're going to be talking about today, like anthropologically speaking, where gods and deities may have arisen from human thought. And then there's also the spiritual side as well of, you know, is there like one God that created people? It just is like, it's kind of like the idea of who created the chicken, or like who came first, the chicken or the egg. And I know that science has already said that the chicken came first because that makes sense. But just, I'm trying to make it relatable, you know? So last week we answered or talked about questions such as who created the gods and why. And we talked about the Big Bang event, which is my idea of that nothing rose into something. That's my idea. And we talked a little bit of a comedy sketch that I thought was interesting that shares sort of the same perspective. And then we moved on to talking about some explanations as to why humans have created the concept of God, i.e. most of these things are philosophical, psychological, and scientific ideas, and they are as followed: comfort in suffering, explaining the unknown, finding meaning and purpose, building cooperative groups, an innate sense of right and wrong, neurological explanations, which was my favorite. We talked about something called the God helmet, which blew my mind a little bit. And then last, I forgot about this. When I was editing last week's podcast, I actually overlooked the last explanation as to why humans may have created the concept of God. And that is a metaphor for spiritual longing. And this is where I want to talk about my life update, because one of our patrons named Anya recently like scrambled my freaking mind. We've been talking about in the Metapsychics Discord server about, you know, the podcast episodes, and the sidekicks had a lovely like discussion, people like throwing things at a wall, seeing what sticks of the podcast episodes that have been coming out. And because of last week's part one to this podcast, one of our lovely patrons named Anya, like I said, scrambled my brain. And it, my husband, if you've been listening to the podcast over the past couple months, in the last few weeks or so, month or two, he's been reading Carl Jung's Red Book, and he's been throwing these ideas at me, and I haven't had time to read the book myself, but he's been sharing the little nuggets of enlightenment that he's been reading about, whether he feels that he can understand them or not, but just ones that he's like, this makes me think of you, or this idea like is crazy. What do you think about it? And honestly, a lot of the things that my husband has been telling me have not been things that I think I am intelligent enough to comprehend. You know how sometimes someone just spits a very large, like spiritual, metaphysical, whatever, like fragment of information at you, and you're like, whoa, I don't think I'm in the right mental space to dissect that, but I feel like it has a lot of meaning and importance, but it's almost like it's lost on you just because you're not in the right frame of mind to receive that information type of thing. I think that's a little bit of what's been happening with my husband and him relaying his enlightened ideas from reading Carl Jung's book. Plus, Carl Jung, I guess, my husband keeps equating him to me and the idea of that he perceives Carl Jung as a medium and or spiritualist just from him reading this book. But Carl Jung processes a lot of metaphysical or spiritual information by dreams. And that is not at all how I process information as a medium. So I think that's another reason as to why it's been hard for me to relate to what and comprehend what my husband has been trying to share with me in his reading. And it's interesting to me, and it's been something that I've been trying to maybe do myself a little bit as well, because my husband's like, you should write down your dreams since you have crazy dreams like this too. I'm like, yeah, but it's like hard for me to do that. So like a lot of the things that I think Carl Jung experienced through his dreams, I experience more just through my own mental mediumship. But anyways, I'm getting off the point. The point is the life update that I wanted to share with you today. I will put in the timestamp if you don't want to listen to it, but I'm also going to give you the caveat of that what Anya wrote in our Discord server about her perspective of gods and deities and how it all interplays with humanity has to do with or is relevant to this week's podcast, this Sunday's podcast. So you might not want to click through it because it is beautiful and amazing and very eloquently worded. And this is what Anya has ruined my life with in a good way. I mean it sarcastically. So Anya says, imagine there is a God, a name for limitless energy that creates light and is never ending. This light is composed of all colors, a realm where everything is possible. Now imagine that God is suddenly born into a human body, living an ordinary day-to-day life. Their mind is almost as normal as everyone else's, but they don't remember that they are a god. They experience life through their body with all its limitations. Although God's divine energy remains within them, they might not feel it, perhaps not even a glimpse of it. As children, they retain a significant portion of self-awareness and self-love, but as they grow older, limiting thoughts and problems increase, gradually overshadowing their connection to this inner energy. They lose sight of what they could achieve with their immense potential. Instead, they perceive themselves as tiny, insignificant beings in a vast universe of humans. The more they believe this, the more it becomes their reality. Their mental cage closes in, and the thought of, what can I even do, grows so overwhelming that it blinds them to their true potential. Now imagine that we, as spectators, are observing this human. We know that God's essence is still within them, intertwined with their being. We think they should feel it, that they shouldn't feel limited, at least not in their minds and hearts. They should be able to create the reality they desire from within. Yet we also see how they are entangled in human struggles, wars, conflicts, and distractions so consuming that it becomes nearly impossible to gain their truth in us. After all, we know the truth. We know that this seemingly ordinary human is God in a tiny body, fully capable of solving their own problems. They simply don't realize it. Perhaps at some point, many of these godly fragments on earth sense an echo of this truth. A part of their divine consciousness whispers to them, there must be more to life. What's the purpose? Why am I here? They sense it in the air. Something feels off. They may begin to believe there must be something greater than themselves, a higher power, a god, or deities who can help them understand their struggles and heal their pain. This idea brings them closer to spirituality, nudging them towards a connection with God, at least in some form. But how can we help them fully reconnect to their divine essence? How can we guide them to shift their focus inward to rediscover God within themselves? If I were a spirit guide, what would I say to help this human rediscover their self-belief? How could we help them to understand that they were and still are God? What steps can we take to help them solve the puzzle of their existence and turn their struggles into dust? How can we change their perspective so they can see beyond the mental drawers they've enclosed themselves in? How can we encourage them to look past labels, names, and forms, the illusions that keep them trapped? Even if the idea of their divine presence is too overwhelming to grasp, perhaps we can help them recognize the immense power they hold within themselves. Change is just a decision away. Even small steps can fill their lives with the light they desperately miss. Each outward action of growth and transformation is a step inward, towards their innermost truth. By evolving and developing, they will gradually gain the consciousness to dissolve these mental labels, freeing themselves from their limitations. If labels no longer matter, then neither do forms or shapes. For example, if our human, who is God, asks what color their candle should be for a ritual of healing, it doesn't really matter. They could use a plastic cup with Mickey Mouse on it if they focus their awareness on the essence of the ritual. What deity is the right one? It's the one that best reflects their true self, enabling them to see their own divine essence mirrored in it. Can this godly human create a deity themselves and summon demons? Sure, you can create your own reality. It can be visible and experienced by others if they decide to join your reality. You can uncreate or destroy things as well, just as you have erased those thoughts. Oh, and that's where it ends. That is just the quote of Anya pondering, and I think that last week, me leaving out some explanations as to why humans have created the concept of God, specifically the one that talks about a metaphor for spiritual longing, this right here, Anya, answers that. And it also helped me to understand as well when you talked about a God within yourself. Bradley came home to me, my husband, and he was telling me how Carl Jung was talking about in his book that there is a God within yourself and that they can be masculine or feminine and they can either be an adult or a child. And I couldn't quite necessarily understand it. And from your phrase, from your ability to write these beautiful things that came from your mind, if not your soul, Anya, that I hope everyone else enjoyed listening to as well. I think I understand now what Carl Jung was trying to talk about and what my husband was also trying to talk about, but you just said it in a different way. And when my husband came home and told me about that concept, it was lost to me, but now I feel that it's found. So that is my life update for the week. This is the quote that is going to haunt me for a while. And I think if you need to go back and listen to that again, because I think as we proceed forward with future podcasts talking about gods and deities and who they are and their anthropological history, their mythology, and how people have integrated them into their lives and their spiritual beliefs, it will be interesting to just sort of think back on that perspective of who is the God within you. And I don't know, man. It's been messing me up, Anya. I appreciate it because I needed that. So without continuing to become emotional, thinking about the lovely thing that one of our sidekicks put in our Discord server. I mean, those are just like, I learned so much from all of you, every single one of you, whether you are a podcast listener, a YouTube watcher, or one of our lovely, lovely patrons in the Discord server. live streams that we have every month. I learned so much from all of you that I don't know. It's December. It's the season of feeling thankful and things like that. And I'm just very thankful for all of you. It makes me very happy. So anyways, without continuing to get emotional on that, let's talk about the anthropology of religion, because that's what I told you we were going to talk about last week, and I'm here for you for it. Ignore all of the pages switching back and forth. I have two separate notebooks that I've been writing notes in about this. If you are interested in the sources in which I found this information, there will be a list at the very bottom of the show notes or in the description below if you're listening on the Metapsychics Extras YouTube channel, because I think it's important for people to cite their work as well as give the resources that you yourself can start to like click through and have Google, Yahoo, Bing, whatever you use to take you down a mythological rabbit hole, as this has been doing to me. So we're going to talk about the anthropology of religion. And this is inspired by my research methodology, at least in this form, because I feel like I've been doing this for almost 5 years now, right, guys? And I feel like trying to research spiritual or metaphysical things usually ends up on some like wonky personal website where someone's talking about their own spiritual beliefs, which is very, very cool. I appreciate it. Everyone's spiritual like experience is valid. But I feel like the websites that I find a lot of information on are more like transient things, like things that people are sharing just to sort of monetize off of it on like a blog website. But the blog isn't like, I don't know. Something I heard the other day is when you read someone's words, you can always like, what was it? It was poetry is beautiful because poets are able to capture feelings and emotions within the words of their lines without using those feelings or emotions or the words for those feelings and emotions like directly. So if someone is talking about sadness in a poem, they will not use the word sadness. However, the words and the way in which they write them on a page exudes the sadness that they feel. And that's something that I've been thinking about a lot lately. Like when I read someone's things, what feelings do I get from them, even though they're not using the words? And I feel like a lot of the information that I find in the spiritual stuff is like very consumeristic ways in which people present information, because it's just like, I don't know. I haven't found very good sources in the past. And because of my spiritual spanking with trying to understand what astral projection was and what astral projection is with my friend Abby, who went to school for anthropology, I was like, you know what? I'm going to try and find anthropological things, because the anthropologists know everything about religion, spirituality, metaphysical things, because they're studying the people that created these things. So like, who else knows besides talking to the souls of the past than the anthropologists, who I believe are in a way talking to the souls of the past, which, oh my goodness, what if we could have an anthropologist on the show, on the podcast, who might actually be a medium as well, because that would be freaking cool. Anyways, let's talk about the anthropology of religion. Specifically, what are relevant prerequisites for human religion? I have a couple. What is it? 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 prerequisites for creating human religion, which, you know, oh, 6. 7. 7. 7 is my final answer. I like wrote circles around bullet points. So relevant prerequisites for human religion. And then possibly, well, we'll wait for that to the end. So relevant prerequisites for human religion. The first one, which we talked about a little bit, I think, in last week, but I saved most of it for this week, is increased brain size relating to neocortex size. So in human brains, the size of our brain peaked around 500,000 years ago. Specifically, the neocortex is presumed to be responsible for neural computations underlying complex phenomena like perception, thought, language, attention, episodic memory, and voluntary movement. So this portion of our brain, which peaked in size with the rest of our brain around 500,000 years ago, is one of the reasons that people think that humans have developed the concept, the idea, the theory, the vision of religion, if you will. There is a specific man, his name is Stephen Jay Gould, who suggests that religion may have grown out of evolutionary changes that favored larger brains as a means for cementing group coherence among savanna hunters after larger brains enabled reflection on the inevitability of personal morality. Can you see how that was hard? The inevitability of personal morality. Say that 10 times fast, people. So this one scientist, you know, when I was reading this, I kind of got annoyed because in school they teach you that the size of your brain does not necessarily correlate to intelligence. And I guess this isn't, I mean, it could be argued. For example, in the olden days when there was much more misogyny and women were supposed to be of a certain class and men were supposed to be of a certain class, sometimes people in law would use the size of a woman's brain in comparison to the size of a man's brain to be like, oh, well, the men are smarter because their brains are bigger. But I tried to like stifle that thought while I was reading this because it more so is when they talk about the size of the brain in the following information that we're going to talk about for relevant prerequisites for human religion, it's more so the sizes of certain areas of the brain as well as the brain size overall in the ability to think complexly and have more of a sentient consciousness when it comes to complex thought processes between species. Not between like people, but between species. So I just wanted to say that because maybe when I read that, you also thought the same thing of like, what does brain size have to do with it? That's a load of malarkey. But it's really not in the ways that they're examining the evidence. So anyways, Stephen Jay Gould suggests that religion may have grown out of evolutionary changes that favored larger brain sizes by means of cementing group coherence among savanna hunters. So I think that's interesting. So they're saying that the neocortex, its increase in size around 500,000 years ago, could be or is thought to be responsible for people being able to reflect on their mortality. So like the fact that life is important, which I don't know. I also kind of want to argue this because like I feel like animals, no matter what, have a sense of mortality. Like when one animal's trying to eat the other, it's not like the other one doesn't care. It doesn't try to like not run away, you know? Like I think that an animal being preyed upon by another one and the instinctual understanding to run away to preserve that prey animal or that animal that's being preyed upon's life is instinctual. So I don't know. I don't know everything about animal behavior and evolutionary science, but I do think that every animal has an understanding of their own mortality because otherwise animals wouldn't run away when another one's trying to eat it or hurt it. So I don't know. I'm trying to give you guys the thoughts that I had ruminating my mind while I was reading these things.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
So let's move on to another reason scientists have found is a prerequisite for human religion. So tool use and the develop of language. So being able to use tools involves your brain needing the ability to envision something that not yet exists. but also has an intended use. Like crows, for example, and ravens, I believe, have been used in a lot of animal behavior studies to understand problem solving, and they actually use tools in order to solve problems like rocks and sticks, etc. So just to add a different species of animal that does not have the same size brain as us, to say that they also use tools and have a language, maybe? I don't know. I won't go that far because they have words, but oh, maybe I should talk about this too. Maybe I'll talk about it when we go into language. Anyways, tool use, envisioning something that doesn't yet exist and also having like an end use for it, takes a large prefrontal cortex. So a larger prefrontal cortex has been shown to be linked to having deeper, more complex ability to comprehend things, the world around you, etc. Having this large, large brain means we also not only have a large neocortex, but we also have a large prefrontal cortex, therefore allowing us to have deeper, complex comprehension about things around us. Now, moving on to the development of language, the individual human brain has to explain a phenomenon in order to comprehend and relate to it. So we're just building upon the areas of the brain that are needed in order or relative to their size to accomplish tasks such as using tools and developing language. I do know, I remember from college, that there is a specific gene that is linked to linguistics or the ability to develop language, which is interesting. Like now with my son, watching him learn and grow and develop, he's working on being able to make more complex sounds and develop words, I guess, from those sounds, but he doesn't know quite yet how to move his mouth and his tongue in the right ways to enunciate or pronounce words. So he uses more so sounds, but I guess, you know, that is the precursor to language. But I also did want to say this as well, since we're just talking about it a little bit. I had this crazy experience last week, right? So I've been doing a lot of pet psychic readings, which has been an absolute blessing because I love meeting people and I also love meeting pets. It's literally just like a double whammy of awesomeness. But for the first time in my 5 years of professionally doing this, right, I talked to a bunny rabbit. His name is Walter. And I finally, like, if anyone's listening and you have like a degree or are interested in animal behavior or communication, like, let me know what you think about this. But this like kind of blew my mind and I want to like share it with people that might be able to like glean more insight or like use it in a cooler way than just like a nugget of information stuck in their brain like it is for me. So I was talking to this bunny. His name was Walter. And he basically was found on the doorstep of his owner's or his current owner's house like years ago at like 3 a.m. His owner was outside feeding one of the like local stray cats, and there was just literally an Angora bunny in his front yard, and he's like, that doesn't belong here, and he like wrestled him into a box and he's like, I'm gonna keep you forever, we're gonna be best friends, we're having soft tacos for dinner. So that is the story of Walter, right? So his owner wanted to know if he A, knew his name, that his name is Walter, and that B, if he knew what his name was before he had a, like before he was their pet, you know? Because he showed me that he was the pet for like children for like a 4-H, you know, like how every year in the summertime when they have fairs, the children will like have their bunnies and they're all different breeds and sizes and whatever. And like the cutest, fluffiest bunny gets like first prize or something like that. And then they're just like family pets, but for 4-H. That's what this bunny was, as far as I can understand from what he conveyed to me before he was with his current owners. So it was interesting what his answer was, because sometimes, I mean, personally, I'm not good with names. That's just me as an individual. And it sort of translates into my mediumship. And that is the answer that I gave to my client who was asking me. But then I really wanted to try. I was like, let me try really, really hard and see if I can get a name for this bunny. Like, what was your name before it was Walter? And it was cool because he doesn't necessarily recognize his name, right? He doesn't know that his name is Walter. However, I could hear in my mind clairaudiently sort of the, what is the word? intonation of what it would sound like if someone was calling his name. So instead of hearing like Walter, I was hearing like, right? So it was more of a sound than a word. And then he also gave me the same thing for what his other name was before he has his current owner. And it was more of like a, get it? Right? So I just like, I've talked to dogs, I've talked to cats, and they will sometimes tell me that they have nicknames, they know what nicknames they like and which nicknames they don't like, and that they know their name, but they usually give me words, or at least I know that they're telling me words, because they'll also tell me phrases or relay phrases to me that their owners talk about them in context, if that makes sense. So like, if you're talking about like, oh, Petey and I are going on a walk today, your dog will let me hear the phrase, Petey and I are going on a walk today. And that's how they know that you're going to take them for a walk, because they hear and recognize those phrases and words. However, Walter the bunny doesn't recognize the words. He recognizes sounds. And that took me for a second, like to like comprehend. And when I told their owner that, they're like, oh, that makes sense to me. I'm like, it does? They're like, well, yeah, because he doesn't necessarily hear words or comprehend words, but he comprehends sounds. And they go, that makes sense, because when we'll call him like, Walter, Walter, how are you doing, Walter? He doesn't answer. But when we come home, we go, Walter, he always comes to us. So he only understands his name with that intonation. And I was like, oh, bunnies don't understand words, but they understand sounds. And words to them only like cognitively reflect in their little brains as sounds. Whereas dogs and cats understand and can comprehend and learn words. Even though they don't hold the genes to have language, they can hear in their minds, just like if you have thoughts in your own mind, they hear those thoughts in your words in their head, and that's how they're able to relay it back to me as a pet psychic. But bunnies don't work that way. So now I've been having like these crazy thoughts of like, what other animals don't understand words, but they understand sounds, and that sounds are like words to them. And then how does that like make a pyramid of cognition and sentience when it comes to like the animal kingdom? Anyways, since we're talking about the develop of language and it's relevantly being a prerequisite for human religion in the scientific community, I figured I should like mind bend you guys with that as well, because it's been messing with me. I want to like find some animal research scientists and be like, listen, do you know that bunnies don't know words, but they know sounds? And I don't know. Is it true? Is it not true? I need someone to tell me, because it's been a wild ride. All right. So moving on to another prerequisite, which is morality and group living, which kind of cross segments. What is a good word? Crosses. Overlaps with building cooperative groups and innate sense of right and wrong, which was one of the explanations as to why humans may have created the concept of God. So like, specifically, primates, dolphins, and whales exhibit attachment and bonding, cooperation and mutual aid, and they also exhibit sympathy and empathy, direct and indirect reciprocity, altruism and reciprocal altruism, conflict resolution and peacemaking, deception and deception detection, community concerns and caring about their self-image, and an awareness of a response to social rules. So like, when it comes to morality and group living, it may have been religion as one of the ways that humans have been able to make people get along. Does that make sense? I think that kind of goes around as well with an innate sense of right and wrong, because they've done studies where babies have a sense of altruism, which is like, this is innately right, this is innately wrong, and the person that's doing the thing that's right, I'm going to help them, and the person that is doing things wrong, they make me uncomfortable. That has been studies with infants, which I think is very, very interesting, because my son, he's not an infant anymore, he's a toddler, but he seems to have an innate sense of right and wrong, even though he is a quite... what's a good name? His biggest nickname right now is the Rapscallion. So that should tell you what his innate sense of right and wrong is. I feel like toddlers, the entire toddler stage is literally just the fuck around and find out stage. They call it toddling, but I think we should call it fuck around and find out, because that's what he does on a daily basis. But he does like to share food. So if he's eating something, he'll come up to you and try to feed you. He'll also come up to the animals and try to feed them, which I think is absolutely adorable. So I do think he has an innate sense of right and wrong and at least sharing and caring. But I don't know. I think when everyone starts to take their morals and put them into a structured way, that could create a religion, which then, again, helps with living in groups or building cooperative groups, which then ties into, like, you have that sense of morality, right? You got that big old prefrontal cortex. If we all get along, maybe we'll survive. So if the babies understand in small scientific settings that helping the person or helping the thing that helps other people will then in turn help them, that's going to turn into cooperative groups, which could become a religion. Anyways, the next portion of why humans may have prerequisites for creating a religion is, and we kind of just segued into this nicely, was adapt advantages. So by including ever-watchful ancestors, spirits, and gods in the social realm, humans discovered an effective strategy for restraining selfishness and building more cooperative groups. The adaptive value of religion would have enhanced group survival, which we kind of just talked about. So in the early Homo evolution, so like Homo erectus, Homo sapiens, just the subset of species of people, Homo, right? It is believed that religious thoughts were evoked. Nicholas Wade believes that religion must have been present in ancestral human populations before the dispersal of people from Africa 50,000 years ago. So there's that theory again, where religion cannot predate the emergence of language, because in order to have a religion, people would have to be able to explain a phenomenon in order to comprehend and relate it to someone else. So people could have been spiritual, they could have had their own religious ideas and beliefs, but if they're unable to communicate those ideas linguistically or in a larger scale, then it would be hard for religion to come about. That's kind of what this portion of research is talking about. So they're saying that around 50,000 years ago, when people just started to disperse from Africa, that is when language was born. And because language rose about, religion emerged around 50,000 years ago. Isn't that interesting? There's lots of different evolutionary like theories. I forget. I think there's two or three that I had to learn about in school, but I always got them confused. And one of them is like the out of Africa dispersal theory. And there's other ones, which I did not research, so I'm sorry, but you can look them up on your own. Again, I did not do well on that test, but, or at least that section of the test. But anyways, they're just saying religion had, like, language had to predate religion, because in order for people to share their beliefs outside of like dancing and body language and watching certain ritualistic practices that may have theoretically taken place before the emergence of language. Language is really what would have sparked the religious revolution in prehistoric people. So I thought that was kind of cool. Now, the next prerequisite is this one I think is pretty cool. And I kind of want to see if you got 23andMe, right? 23andMe, that like gene testing thingy where they talk about your religions and stuff. Let's talk about the God gene hypothesis, right? Okay, so the God gene hypothesis states that some variants of a specific gene, the VMAT2 gene, predispose people to embracing spirituality. 23andMe, are you listening? Do you want to sponsor this podcast and also offer VMAT2 gene analysis to your gene panel? Because that would be kind of cool. I don't know. Maybe would it start problems? Would it not start problems? You all have started problems in the past with like uncovering people's things. So why not just add another one? Because I would pay for that. Anyways. Isn't that interesting that there's a gene? So it's more like people that, I don't know. They talked about more like, they talked about people when I read this God gene hypothesis, that some people that are more predisposed to spirituality also are predisposed to having like larger families and wanting to be in larger like social groups versus people that do not want to have larger families and that are more reclusive in their social lives. So I'm not sure. Maybe it has to do with like a lot of different genes, but they talked about this one gene, the God gene, which I thought was cool. Could you imagine being a gene and scientists give you the name, the God gene? Like all the genes get together in the pool and they're like, hey, what's your name? He's like, I'm the God gene. Okay, I'll stop. All right. So we also have the triune brain. So the triune brain is actually three parts of your brain that help in different capacities. So the triune is made up of the reptilian brain, which is quote unquote the oldest part of the brain, the most like one linked to instinctual things, stuff that you don't necessarily have to think about, but that are ingrained in your DNA from like the primordial times in which human life arose. Then you have your limbic system and your, again, neocortex. So these parts of the brain, the triune brain, all work in different capacities, both together and individually, to shape collective religious behaviors and beliefs, as well as personal ones. So this also may be a prerequisite to the formation of religion in an anthropological sense. Now, the last one that I want to talk about is intentional burials or religious significance. So one of the oldest intentional burials took place 100,000 years ago in a cave in Israel. I got the name of the cave, but I can't pronounce it. So if you look up oldest intentional burial, you'll find the name, I promise you. But this is where people were buried with grave goods, as well as animal remains and tools and things like that. So I know we talked about how religion had to come about at least 50,000 years ago because of the emergence of language and humans. However, you can always argue the fact that there were intentional burials, and because of intentional burials, that leads scientists to believe that some species, especially humans, do grieve the death and loss of loved ones. So it's just like, where did religion start? Did it start with big brains? Did it start with language? Or did it start with burials? Because elephants have been burying, in a sense, they're dead for like a really long time. Like what, is there any, it's not anthropologists, archaeologists out there that have been able to find like the oldest elephant graveyard? Because elephants are known to, I mean, they can't really bury their dead because of the environment that they live in and the circumstances in which they die, but they do remember where their loved ones or their past relatives are like remaining for the rest of existence, and they will visit them every year and mourn the loss of those loved ones. So how long have elephants been quote unquote burying their dead? And would people or scientists think of that as a religious practice? I also know that elephants have been known to quote-unquote worship the moon, or at least have intentional and cognizant interactions with the moon cycles, which I also think is completely mind-boggling. And so I don't know. That is the anthropological prerequisites for religion being developed in humans, but I also think that those ideas and aspects could go outside of humans themselves for different reasons. And it's just an interesting thing to think about when it comes to understanding how or why the idea of gods or gods came about. Now, with that being said, we're going to talk about next week some of the first gods in anthropological history. Specifically, and I haven't decided on any other ones yet, but I have decided on picking on Chaos. Chaos is one of the first Greek gods. And when I say one of the first, I mean like the first. And when we're talking about it in an anthropological sense, there's a couple. One, there's Anu, who's a sky god. There's Enki, who's a water god. Enlil, who's an air god. Ishtar, who's one of the first known deities that was written down with evidence, and she's a love goddess. And then we have Chaos, Gaia, Eros, Erebus, Tartarus, and Nyx. And those are more Greek goddesses. So if you're listening and you have just read or heard me read some of the first gods in anthropological history, then let me know in the comments below which one you want to hear about. We are going to start with Chaos, and I know I put a poll on Patreon as well for people to throw in their own ideas into the pot of future podcasts, if you will. And I will be taking all of those into consideration. But if you want to leave the God that you want to listen to or have a podcast talk about, please let me know in the comments below. Until next time, thank you so much for listening to this Sunday's podcast. I hope you all enjoyed. I've been having fun just like giving you guys things to think about. Again, this podcast is not in any way, shape, or form to tell you what to believe or think or say is right or wrong. This is just shiznit that's going through my brain, my guys. And I am excited to learn about the ways you guys interpret it, the way you would perceive it, and the things that you want to do with it, thoughts you've built and create and mull over and extrapolate on. So anyways, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, peace.